Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, we have on the line Clive Chen. Clive, are you there?
Yes, my brother. I'm right here, live and direct.
Well, let me just tell you what I found just last night, Clive. I was thinking about the interview today, and I'm going through my tapes, and I look, and I said, oh, man. I just found this interview from 1998, July of 98, and a great interview. I mean, what information you had on that interview? The problem was that my voice sounded very, very muffled. We have things secure here now, so the listeners can hear both of us with clarity. And I want to say, Clive, what have you been doing since? And that was 8 years ago, brother. So what have you been doing lately?
1998.
Yeah,
man. Yeah, it's a good while.
Time flying, man.
Yeah, you remember that. Yeah, well, I've been pretty much active, you know, still within the business framework. You know, I've been still compiling compilations for various reggae labels, you know, like Soul Jazz, Blood and Fire, Pressure Sounds, and recently one with a label named Motion, and they're all based in England.
Ah. Yeah. Now, is Motion the label that you did with Lynn Tate and the Jets? Was that Motion?
Yes.
Ah.
Yeah. Okay. That was on Motion.
Mm-hmm.
It was called Out on a Funky Trip.
Right.
Yeah, other than that, you know, I've been doing other little things, like I've been reissuing some Revival 7-inches for my collectors out there on the Impact label, and also I've done a five-color set on the Randy's Ska stuff from the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple other interested collectors, like the Count Machuki single called Pepper Pot. I just had that one reissued just a month ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And you're still working with...
pretty active, you know, plus, you know,
Working with Jammy Land, still
working? Pardon?
You're still working with Jammy Land?
No, I'm pretty much doing that myself.
Okay.
Independently on my own, you know?
Okay. Well, that sounds good to me, Clive, because I know you have a wealth of music stored up there and stuff that people haven't even heard, you know? So I know, and you've been doing it from that time. And
right. And
as I was listening to that interview, Clive, I said, this is almost like another generation coming out. It's new listeners need to know about Clive Chen. And so let's go back and talk about the beginnings, Clive. And for listeners that may not be aware of you or, you know, VP Records or Randy's, can you tell us a little bit about where it all began?
Well, it all began for me back in 1968 when I first, you know, got introduced to the recording end of it through my father recording studio at 17 North Parade, Kingston, Jamaica. But before that, you know, I was pretty much aware of the recording industry because my dad set up Randy's recording studio and record shop back in the early 60s. Used to take me around to different venues, different recording studios, and also occasionally I would meet his artists and musicians when they come to our residence up in Vineyardtown.
Mm-hmm.
We live on Deanery Road in Vineyardtown.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was aware of all these things pretty much as a lad, you know, until I was old enough to step into the studio and start doing my own recording in 1968. And, you know, it blossomed for me from there on. You know, I had the opportunity to work with some real giants in the music industry. You know, just to name a few, Augustus Pablo, Dennis Brown, John Holt, Ken Boot, Delroy Wilson, Orton Celis, you know, numerous And groups like Heptones, the Gladiators, the Ethiopians, you know, the Slickers. You know, I was blessed, put it that way, to have that opportunity and a first hand coming into the business and, you know, blossom from there for me, you know, until I came to the United States in the late 70s. And from there on, you know, we developed a small record shop on Jamaica Avenue in 1967. No, sorry, in 1976.
Mm-hmm.
77, sorry. I'm getting the years mixed up now. It's been so long. But, yeah, you know, we started out a small record retail shop in Jamaica Avenue back in the summer of 1977, and it was called the VP Records.
I remember that
now
place.
Now the leading reggae label in, should we say, the world? Yeah, I know for the United States, but I'm not quite sure for the world.
It's out there.
We've been around.
It's there. They've been out there for quite a while, man. And I just want to say, give thanks for VP Records, you know, and the works that they have done. And also, but here's a question I have for you, Clive. Mm-hmm. With all of the, you know, being the number one distributor of reggae music in the United States and beyond, why hasn't VP ever made built a studio of its own?
I guess primarily because they saw it as a reason, because, you know, we had a studio before.
Right.
And there was no reason to not set up another one here in the States. But my whole feeling is that, being that when we came up as, you know, fresh coming in from Jamaica, we saw where we had the opportunity of licensing independent producers materials here, representing it here.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no real need to, at that time, to like say, okay, let's sign this artist or let's sign this group or let's sign this label. It was just basically a distribution setup where we would get products from like Lee Perry, Bonnie Lee, Clancy Eccles, Sonny Pottinger. So there was, at that time, there was really no need for a recording studio to be set up in New York. But as time went on, and we, in the early 90s, like I'd probably say about 1991, when we started doing the Strictly the Best compilations and the Total Recall compilations, that's when the label came into effect. That's when the birth of the label, VP, came into effect. That and then we started seeing the light to sign artists because, you know, the majors were stepping in and started signing, you know, like Shabba Ranks and Super Cat and, you know, just to name a few at that particular time.
Right.
And at that particular time, then there was really a need for a recording studio. But then, you know, artists were going back and forth doing their thing and then, you know, coming up with their own tracks. And we just decided that, you know, rather than building a studio, let's just set up a mastering studio. We do have a studio, but it's just primary to cut masters.
I see.
And we do editing, you know, like putting the tracks together there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so there was really no great need for a recording studio.
Well, the reason I asked you that question is that I was reading something about you, and I know you miss it because that was a great part of the whole thing of you being in there and creating. And, you know, I was reading about you and the late Errol Thompson now, and you know, and how you guys just were creating stuff, and, you know, it was just like beautiful. I mean, you love that because you're allowed to do that.
Right.
So, you know, that's why, you know, I was saying, well, you know, and I thought about it, and I said, well, I can imagine VPs having a studio here, you know.
Right.
But as you say, they do the mastering.
Yeah, you know, we had set up the mastering back, I believe the mastering was done around mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was around 85, 86 when the mastering studio was set up. But, you know, there was other studios around that we used. We had good relationship with HCNF out in Freeport, Long Island.
Right.
We had great works with, you know, guys like this guy in Brooklyn called again, Yard Music Production.
Big Yard?
Big Yard. No, not Big Yard. That's... That would be Robert...
Livingston.
Livingston.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah.
There's another guy, I think Sydney...
Sydney Mills?
Sydney Mills, yes.
That's my boy. That's my
right.
boy. Yeah,
that's true. It's somewhere out there on Church Avenue. I think it's a living room studio.
Yeah, that's Sydney, because Kevin just released it. Kevin Batchelor just released the album on that label, you know, with
Yeah, you know, there's, you know, quite a few studios around, you know, the tri-state area. And, you know, there was really no great need, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to just say that we have come a long way. We, you know, we've been around in the business pretty much over 40 years now. Well, I physically have been in the business over 30 years, 35 years, coming this year. And, you know, it's not, I would probably say it was not easy in the beginning because it was, very hard, a lot of hard work, a lot of time dedicated. You know, we had to spend numerous amount of hours a day trying to get certain things going, get labels, get, you know, records sent out to be manufactured, get a driver to distribute them on the road. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Setting up, you know, various accounts, throughout the United States.
So that's hard. That's some hard work.
But it has paid off. You know, paid off because now you can sit back and say, well, all what was being done back then, you can see that it's benefiting. You know, it's gratifying that at least it wasn't in vain.
Ah.
All that hard work was
serious thing, man. Two things I remember is where the word Randy's came from a record store in the United States, and
yes, the name was taken from a radio show that was being broadcast on the broadband in Jamaica. And I can't remember the name of the radio station, to be exact.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But the program was sponsored by a record store called Randy's.
Okay.
In Nashville, Tennessee.
Ah, that's what I was trying to remember. Nashville, Tennessee. Wow.
Yeah, the store was originally from Nashville. And my father fell in love with the name, Randy's.
Uh-huh.
And he adopted the name back in the late 50s. And, you know, that's where it all sprung from, you know. That he was, you know, also called on occasionally Randy himself.
Right. Himself. Okay. So that's what, because
they call him Mr. Randy.
Okay. The next thing is that I'm gonna remind you of something you told me once, that you went to a VP function and somebody didn't know what was Randy's. Remember that?
Oh yes.
What's
they
Randy?
They couldn't affiliate the VP. With Randy's. They had no clue of what Randy's were. But, you know, because obviously, you know, it takes people like yourself that has the interest of the music, number one.
Mm-hmm.
The love, too, and the grace to make people know that, you know, this is where it's coming from. But, you know, these young guys up here nowadays, they just, you know, affiliate VP with just VP. They can't go into the roots of it to say, where did this name VP come from? You know, and a lot of people up to now still can't figure out what's the significance of VP. What does VP stand for?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it can stand for many things. It could stand for yes, please. Or, I mean, very please.
Very please.
Very please, you know, as well as, you know, very special, you know.
Very positive.
Positive, exactly. You know?
But we know it's...
Actually, V is for Vincent, which is my dad. And P is for Patricia, which is my stepmom.
Uh-huh,
so
okay.
That's how the V and the P came into the equation. And primarily the reason for that is because my dad didn't want to use the name Randy's to be confused with his brother's business in Brooklyn, which at the time he had a business set up there back in the late 60s called Chin Randy's.
That's where I used to go. See, now that could have been very confusing, Clive, because that's where I used to go. So I associated that.
Yeah, well, you know, my dad actually had... his hand in that back then from the start of that business.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, Uncle Victor, he's deceased now. He was a trained technician, and he used to fix radios, televisions back then.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this little tiny repair shop on Schenectady Avenue between St. John's and Lincoln Place.
We know where that
my
is.
My father would come up in the 60s and, you know, visit his family because his other two brothers, Victor and Keith, was living there, and his sister, Daphne and Molly. And, you know, he sat them down one day and said, "Why, you know, Victor, why you just don't use that store that you're repairing all these radios and all these televisions and just put one part of it into a record shop, and I will help you. I will supply you, get records for you from Jamaica." And it so happens that my uncle took him up on the offer, and that's how, you know, my uncle started his first record shop by, you know, adding records into his technician shop. And he saw that the records was doing better than his actual servicing because
you
carry one radio there for service and you have to wait until the end of the week or the end of the month for this man to come back and pay you. While if you could sell several hundred records, and he was the only record shop that was carrying Caribbean music in the entire New York, not even in just in Brooklyn, but in entire New York.
Wow. So Moody's wasn't even up in the Bronx at that time.
No.
Right. Moody's was nowhere
Moody's
near the Bronx
and
then.
Brad yeah. and all of those guys weren't there.
Yeah.
Know? I think the only other Caribbean store that was around at the time was a store called, it was over on Utica Avenue, a store called Strikers.
Ah, I've been in there too.
This guy was from, I think, he was from
Trini?
St. Vincent.
Oh, St. Vincent, okay. Because I know he had a lot of Calypso. Vincent. He had a lot of Calypso in there.
A lot of Calypso. You know, he represented Singing Francine,
mm-hmm.
Stalin, and all those guys, you know, from them era, you know.
Yeah, Calypso man.
Calypso Pros, you know, all those legendary Calypso singers, you know.
Yes, man.
So, yeah, that was, you know, back at that time. And, I mean, it was very interesting to see how, you know, at that time, that how hungry Caribbean people were to buy their own. It's just like, you know, we traveled to another country and, you know, we're in a Caribbean community and we try to support each other. Like, you know, a baker might set up around the corner. Obviously, you're going to go and buy your bread and buy your beef patties or mm-hmm. vegetable patties, and you support them. Then you need your Jamaican newspaper, you know, to keep on top of what is happening in the island.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is how things started back then
mm-hmm.
to what it is now in this 21st century, you know. You know, you're going to Brooklyn, every corner has a jerk chicken place, every corner has a patty shop. you know, every corner has a roti shop, you know.
It's amazing, man. I miss it. I haven't been there in a while, Clive. It's amazing, man. You know, it's like, I love it. Flatbush Avenue, I know the places I'm going to check, man. And then, you know, the first time I ever saw you was in your shop.
Yeah, well, when I came up back in Leeds, I came up in 1977, you know, not for the first time, but to actually settle in, and I saw the opportunity for a Caribbean restaurant in Queens because there was none, and guess what, you know, where we were with a record shop was called Jamaica Avenue, but more fitting.
Right.
To have a record shop and a restaurant, a food shop on Jamaica Avenue.
You feel good, man. You feel like, hey, man, this ain't that far from home.
Yeah, man. And I mean, you know, when I started into that food business, boy, it kicked off so well, Charles, that we didn't have a hand to sell food.
Wow.
We didn't have a hand to sell food. I mean, if we could have opened 24/7, we could have done excellent. But, you know, it's a lot of work. It's strenuous because you got to get up early. You got to open up. You got to start cooking. You got to, you know, you end up closing late because all that cleaning up, all that pots and pans have to be washed and turned down for the following day. So it had a lot of work, and it took a big toll out of me because I did it for 8 solid years. You know, until I said, you know, boy, I don't know if I can continue this. I need to settle back in and rekindle to see where I can get myself back into the music because I was losing out on my music. You know? Although I did still got support from, you know, these guys around the place like Keith. You know, he passed away now, you know. I'm talking Keith Hudson,
yes, man.
Glenn Adams and Brown and, you know, all these guys that were in New York that would come around and support me and sit in, you know, Roland Alfonso, you know, would come in and sit in and buy him soup and, you know, we would have a chat and Ray. But, you know, all this is just phases that one's passed through life, you know what I mean?
True.
Part of the whole exodus, you know, it's a part of what I, you know, personally was involved with, you know, the music, entertainment, the food, and the love of the people, you know what I mean?
I want to ask...
I've been around some really positive people, including yourself, man.
Thank you, Clive. I want to ask you a question. It's a general question. It may be a tough question to ask. I mean, to answer. It's the state of the music today. I mean, because that's a broad statement. You know, what do you feel? Because, you know, I mean, it's probably complex because you could answer it in a lot of different ways. But in general, what do you feel the state of where the state of the music? And I'm not talking about guys making a lot of money, but in general, where the music is today.
Well, I mean, from my outlook on it, I mean, I am on the actual edge looking into the mix of everything. Because I haven't been physically or spiritually involved in any sort of recording in the industry for a good 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've helped out quite a lot on, you know, side jobs, working and doing overdubs, doing a few mixes for some young guys like the Slackers with your, you know,
my friends.
2003.
Yeah, man.
And also, you know, working with some other young guys in England on their projects, the Gold Master Group. And just to come back to what you're saying, it's like, it has come a long way. It has transparent from the early settings of the music business. You know, when I say the early settings, I'm talking the foundation, artists and musicians from the 50s and the 60s coming up. We set a foundation for these guys that are currently recording their music and currently touring with their music. But it has presently being somewhat of a little disappointment, personally to me, because I don't really and honestly see any creativity. I'm talking about their, not their lyrics so much, but their music.
Same rhythms, you mean?
Yeah,
need to change up.
And they're using the old school music and modernizing it to a fashion, but it's not their originals. In other words, they'll take a studio one rhythm, they'll sample it, they will put probably different percussions, or they might put a different drum. Well, not so much a drum. They try to capture the original drums, because the original drums, I don't see any of these new musicians mastering that.
Mm-hmm. Is that, there you go, Clive. Key words you just said, new musicians. Do you feel that is one of the reasons that we don't have enough young people that really become full-fledged musicians?
Right.
Okay.
I mean, they can play something over exactly the same way.
Mm-hmm.
They can't come up with something original of their own. You understand me? In other words, you see like how the foundation musicians, like, I'll give you one instance, like Carl Masters or Lloyd Nibbs,
mm-hmm.
or say, my personal drummer at the time when I was recording was a guy called Lloyd Adams, a.k.a. Tin Leg. Santa Davis.
Okay.
You know, which is Carlton Davis, but he's called Santa.
Santa, one of my favorite drummers too, man.
Right, from out of the old school, he's a full syndicate drummer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these guys would play their original drum rolls, and they'll play the symbolics at a very unique style. I mean, you didn't have to like tell them; they just have the feel.
Mm-hmm.
You understand me? They come to the studio and they're ready to go. And once you get them warmed up, there's no stopping.
Forget about it. Yeah, man.
The whole day.
Yeah, all day long.
All day long.
Well, you know what, Clive? I saw Santa backstage before a show, and it's something I never saw anybody do. This guy was jogging back and forth. It's like stay in shape, because he's going for the long, he's in for the long haul, you know. And that's a dedicated artist there, man. And I don't see that we have the same thing today. It's just a different time. It's just a different time, man.
Right. No, it's just like I was talking to someone just recently, and they were saying, boy, we could do a recording and get all these old musicians, I shouldn't use the word old, but all these legendary musicians back into the recording studio and do some new music. And I was like, yeah, that sounds great, but if you're trying to say to get the same feel, there's no way you can get that.
Mm-mm.
I mean, that is a past.
That's done.
Because during them time, it was a different period. Everything was, to me, was glowing. You know, the musicians were glowing, the artists were glowing, the engineers were glowing, and the studios were glowing, because they all had their sound. I mean, Studio One had its sound, Duke Reed had its sound, Federal, Dynamics, Randy's, they all had their sound,
A distinct sound. Each studio got a distinct sound.
Sort of like, sorry?
Each studio would have a distinct sound, is what you're saying.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
oh,
okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that is my analysis, because I could hear a song even before I see the record of a label. I could tell you where it was recorded. Coxon, he had a wicked bass, but you couldn't really hear his drum tracks. The drum tracks were very muffled, and I guess it's not because he couldn't get that middle range, but it's probably, the mics he used. Probably is, how many mics he used, because, back then, one never used to think of miking every piece of instrument. It would probably might just be one boom mic and everybody playing whatever being picked up around in the room being picked up.
So economics too. It was
economics. Yeah,
yeah, man.
You know, because you'd use an RCA mic, which would be a homodirectional mic, and you'll try and get a guy playing over in the corner and one guy playing in the other corner. And, you know, even when you were taking horn cuts, you know, and you had five horn men, you have one mic. So each time a man is going to do a solo, he steps forward to the mic.
I see.
And I've seen that happen when Scatterlights were recorded for my father. And they used to set a milk crate for Roland, because Roland was short.
Yeah, man.
You know, he had to step up on the milk crate to take his solo.
Wow.
Because Tommy was taller than him.
Wow, wow.
You know?
Yeah, man. That's amazing. Amazing thing that goes on in the studios and the you know, because we talked, I was listening to that interview, and we talked about effects and Mr. Thompson and how he would put a microphone in the toilet bowl. I laughed at that, man. I said, you know, well, Hudson did the same thing with driving a motorbike in the studio, you know. When you don't have a lot of money, you just do these.
No, you have to do it the conventional way.
Yeah, man.
You know, if you can't have the technology to get sound effects to put into your mixes, you create them. And the conventional way to create them is to go the creative way, you know. You want to flush it, just get it from a toilet. If you want something tumbling down, you just set up some boxes and you just knock them down. Or you want some crashes, you just crash a couple of boxes. You know, you want some jingles, you just get jingles. But, I mean, those times are very exciting, Charles. I mean, you know, those days... You find excitement into what you're doing.
Oh, yeah, man. I got to say this, Clive. Like, Derek, I'm thinking of one right now. It's Derek Harriott with the cut Bomb Scare. Bomb Scare. Yes. You can hear them running in the background, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Very exciting, man. I love it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was even, I heard Big Ute, an local interview just recently, and he was talking to someone about his days working in Randy's, and he was giving this little chat. And, you know, when I was doing all my voices, we would hear the buses running up and down North Parade. And, you know, it was very exciting. And I would tell her, don't take those out. I mean, that is part of the music. You know?
That's a part
so
of it.
So intriguing when he said that, because it's true. We used to get leaks inside the studio sometimes of buses roaring up and down North Parade, you know?
Serious thing. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I did a mix once, and, you know, it was an accidental thing that happened when I was mixing down the Augustus Pablo album. This track was called Too Late. And, you know, the mixes were being just running from, you know, from the master tapes, from, you know, the track one right down. So when it came to Too Late, I was listening to it, and, you know, I'm just there smoking a spliff, and I'm listening to the music, And one mind just said, just touch this fader. And I just, boop, and touch it, feeling, and I look at me and say, but Russ, man, what happened? What you did that for? And I look at him and say, what I did? He said, you don't see what you did, man. He's a mix for taking in a Rasta. And you see, when we finish, we listen forward. And the man them said, boy, it's the most exciting part of the music. That little piece was the most exciting part of the music. Everyone that heard them said, but how did you get that into it? And I said, boy, you wouldn't believe it, but it was a mistake. So every piece of mistake becomes a piece of, you know.
So that's how creativity comes. It's mistakes happen. And
Yeah, these things happen. I mean, you know, we just said, just make it roll, man.
Well, here's...
Stop this, no, because if you're going to stop the tape and go forward, just do it back the way it's supposed to do perfectly, it probably wouldn't have that feel. It wouldn't have that, you know, it's like you make a stew and you throw in some pimento in it, and boy, you feel like you throw too much pimento in, but boy, when you taste a pot, man, it tastes wicked. because that extra pimento you throw in becomes so distinctive that you lick all your top lip and your bottom lip and your five finger, your 10 fingers.
Yeah. Okay, Clive, here's a question that people ask, people that hear reggae, maybe they haven't been listening a long time, and then you throw a word to them like dub music. Can you, as quick as possible, tell how you would interpret what, explaining what dub music means to somebody? Because they ask that question all the time. What is dub music? You know, what is dub?
Well, dub music, let me try to explain it in my way.
Okay.
Because there's other ways and contexts you can explain dub. Because there's definitions, you know what I mean? Some would want to say, what is D-U-B? Dub.
True.
Well, to me, dub is a breakdown of the rhythm. It's the actual stripping of the rhythm tracks. Because during the late 60s, when we had a rock steady period, on the B side of every vocal tune, there was an instrumental to the vocal tracks. Right? You'd either have a horns instrumental with the supersonics or the scatterlites or whoever was going to be doing the horns. And then you'd have the keyboards, which would either be Winston Wright or you'd be Ansel Collins or whoever, Jackie Mittoo, whoever, right? And then there was the guitars. You'd have Lynn Tate or you'd have Ox Brown or you'd have whoever, you understand, Ernest Ranglin, whoever was at the there at that present time. Because it depends on who was in the studio or who was available.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
That was the rock steady period, that short lived, just a year.
Now, who were the horns in during that period? What horn men would you have had during that period?
During my period would be Tommy McCook, Marquess.
Herman Marquess, yeah.
Yes, Herman Marquess, Bobby Ellis. Richard Dirty Harry All, because he keeps the riff.
Right. I remember what you said about that. No solo, Harry, just riff.
Yes, just the riff. And then you'd have like Vin Gordon, trombone, you know, so that was the basic rhythm section, horn section, right? But coming up now in the early 70s, after the rocksteady phase, then you would have a period where you'd have the A side of a vocal tune, on the B side you'd have just the rhythm, just the plain rhythm. Probably it started out with a voice and then comes in the rhythm. And that we called the version. Right?
Okay.
Just the rhythm. Then 71, 72, we started experimenting, myself and Errol. We started to strip. We started to take the piano, the guitars, the percussions, and we just went with drum and bass. And then started to tease it. When I said tease, I mean just like, boop, a little rhythm part. And then we pull him out again. Boop, the horns part. Tease him again. Draw him out. Boop, the vocals.
Okay.
And then at the intros, we kind of like put up the phaser for the echo chamber. You understand me?
And this is all experimentation. First time you guys trying this.
Wow. But we strip the rhythm down to the foundation, which is the basic core of the rhythm, which is the drum and the bass. That's what we concentrate on, the drum and the bass.
Okay.
And then we just feed it with the rhythm track, because during that period of time, it was just a half-inch four-track analog we used to use. So we have drum and bass on one track, rhythm on one track, horns on one track, and the vocals on one track. And
wow.
So we just play. But the basic core is the drum and the bass. That's the concentration of the drum and the bass. You have that mixed and covered with a little echo, a little reverb at the tail end or whatever. And that's how we generated the dub.
Wow.
Because, you know, between myself, Errol, Herman Chinloy, and Scratch were the three main players when it came to the...
This is before Tubby then, even.
Of course. Tubby's took what we had, and he modified it.
Uh-huh.
You understand me? He put his own little spice. In other words, when we did the hardcore cooking, Tubby's did...
The seasoning.
You know, he did his little spice, and he threw in his little bits of seasoning, his little thyme and his little pepper. You understand me?
Yeah, man.
But we were the first foundation, because Java, Java, Java Dub is the very first album. Then that came Aquarius Dub. Then came Blackboard Jungle.
There was
a fight in the music industry, which one was first, because they came out simultaneously around the same period.
Now, I just got Aquarius
Dub. My Dub album was the very first one because of the limited edition that we did on that.
Wow. So now I can listen to it.
We did it for the commercial market. We actually did it for the sound people.
Wow.
You know, we did it for the sound name. You know?
Now I can listen to all these things and compare them, because, you know, this is history. And it needs to be known, you know, because it just needs to be known, man.
Yeah.
And I want to say to you, Clive, that, you know, I've been telling you this a long time. You're very responsible. And VP needs to let the world know that Clive is responsible. I mean, you're a part of the family, but and something you said to me before is that VP should not forget Randy's. You know,
you cannot forget the roots, because when you forget the roots, boy, you know, it's very hard for the branches to stay firm.
Serious thing, man.
It's just like, you know, you have a beautiful plant. It becomes nourished to the point that it started blossoming some nice, pretty flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden you click the roots, then the flower would wither. The branches would die.
Serious thing, man.
So, you know, they can't, you know, and they have realized that. They have realized that they could not afford to not recognize the fact that that's where they started. So with their merchandise goods now, and their 25th anniversary that they celebrated, was last year.
Something like that.
The last year, 2005. Yeah.
Man, I saw that
they
article.
They started to recognize the fact that Randy's has to be visible.
Ah.
When I was telling them all along that, you know, sure, you should have done that from the get-go. You know?
Well, when I saw that article, Clive, I saw that article, and I said to myself, man, VP has gone clear. They're in the business section of it was the Daily News or the Times, and a big article, and you know, and I say, oh, wow, that's important news. But I say, you know, they need to put in there the beginnings of it. Before they came here, they need to put in there about what was happening on North Parade.
Say the thing about it is that they couldn't really say much, because they didn't really, I mean, when I said they, I'm talking about my brothers,
mm-hmm.
because I don't want to get the public, your listeners, confused, and I use the word they.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I should be more plain forward with what I'm saying. I'm speaking in terms of my blood.
Okay.
You know, Christopher Chin and Randy Angela, they should know that, you know, you cannot disclose, or you cannot just not mention Randy's, because that is the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, although you weren't part of it back in the 60s and the 70s, you have to mention it. And if you want to be fully more knowledgeable about it, you don't want to say anything and you don't say it properly, bring in Clive. Bring in your brother. You know what I mean? Say, hey, you know, my brother's was the starting, him and my father. But I guess, you know, sometimes one try to, you know, forget about, you know, another one, and, you know, you can't do that.
It happens, but then you're going to have
it
people
happens,
like me.
But then, you know, it will fall back on you, because, you know, people tends to want to dig deep.
Well, I'm a spark it, Clive.
They want to get in a half story of it. They want to know the full story.
I'm a spark it.
Yeah.
You know, because it happened, it's history, and it needs to be told.
Of course.
You know?
It's just like the Bible. If you're going to speak of the Bible, you have to give the full length of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, You know, you can't get the New Testament when you don't know the Old Testament.
That's a serious thing, man. Serious thing. So, yeah. You got some new music you're going to send me, Clive? I mean...
Yeah, man. Matter of fact, you see, when I heard, I was over by David's apartment in the early part of this week, and he said to me, you know, right? Charles calls me up and says, "Was Bertie?" And I said, "Oh my gosh, it's Charles Bertie. We have to call him up and hail him up to the podium." You know? And then I said to myself, you know, what more soothing more than giving him a nice little gift package of sweet reggae music?
Serious thing, brother.
Really mind blowing tune. And I want to tell you too, you know, I have a nice package set up for you because I have five of the reissues on the Randys in color vinyl, each of them in five different colors.
Wow.
You understand me? And I know you'd be very happy with such a big smile on your face.
Yeah, man. Yeah, of course.
I have five on Impact that wasn't available back in the 60s or 70s. And I said, you know, I have to get these to Russ because I know that you'd love these. You know, I have Max Romeo. I have a Slickers. I have Roots.
Don't tell me no more, man. You're making my mouth water.
And then I have one with, the first DJ that ever put his mouth on a mic. Not Stitch. A lot of people think Stitch is the very first. But a man by the name of Count Machuki.
Oh, man.
The first man to pick up a mic to toast on Studio One sound back in the 50s.
Wow.
A man called Count Machuki.
I know that name, man. Count Machuki.
It's really hot. Hotter than Pepper Pot. It is Pepper Pot.
I'm really looking forward to that, man. I'm definitely. And you know, I talked to David, and we're going to do an interview because I think the people need to know about him and his photography.
No, man, definitely.
You know,
then I think he's up for it too. You know what I mean?
Yeah, man.
He's up for it. You know, so that would be nice.
I'm gonna tell you who I interviewed December 18th. I got some of the words to one of the cuts you made dedicated to him straight to somebody's head.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, he called here the 18th, man. But see, we got into a thing, and it's a whole other stuff. We could talk for another 2 hours, Clive, because it's the issue of Sinead O'Connor that came up. You know, but I'm not going to even expound on that, because that could go on for more days and days. You know, I'll just say this. The question was, why no Jamaican woman hasn't done all these tunes that Sinead did? Now, that's a whole other subject.
Yep.
That we don't want to go into now. But listen, hey, I'm going to stay in touch with you. You got my address, right, Clive?
Yeah, man. Yeah.
And you know...
I'm going to have this thing sent to you. Tomorrow's a national holiday.
Right.
It's post on Tuesday.
Okay.
We'll get it around Wednesday, Thursday, hopefully.
Sounds good.
I'll make sure that the Senate's priority.
You know who's coming up here Wednesday? I haven't seen any live music in quite a while, but Meditations are coming Wednesday night to the Heart in Ithaca, New York. So
okay, cool.
I'm looking forward to that.
You'll up Ansel for me.
Definitely.
Them guys, I mean,
he's a bad boy today, Clive. He's supposed to call me at 1 o'clock, the top of the show.
Probably don't get up yet, man.
No. No, man. I get on his case. I get on his case. He was supposed to call. He was supposed to call last week, Clive. You know what he told me this week? It was my wife's birthday.
So
he said, "I'm going to call the top of the show." Yeah. So I want to hear the excuse he's going to give me when I see him Wednesday. Because, you know, I think he might have tried to call while we were talking, but I don't pick up no phone. Generally speaking, I ain't going to pick up no phone during an interview. You know, I seen the light going on, and that might be him because he never calls on time.
Right.
But I will hail him up, and I want to thank you. And we will be in touch, man. And,
definitely.
You know, And I burned the CD right now because we got a CD burner. So I'm burning this now. So you'll get a copy of this interview, too.
And, okay, nice one.
And I'm going to send you a copy of the other one when I transfer it. I'm going to send you a copy of that because I really think that was a good interview. It's just that you couldn't hear my voice clearly. So,
okay.
That's 8 years ago. So then you could see what has happened. You know, some of the people that we have, you know, one good friend of yours that passes. You know, and you mentioned it was, you know, the sound man, Thompson, Mr. Thompson, you know, So, you know, things happen in 8 years' time, lots of things, good things and, you know, bad things. So, but I think most of them have been good things. We're still here, Clive. That's the good thing.
Right.
We're still breathing.
That is true.
And we're still trying
to keep up the good work.
Oh, yeah, man. I'm going to do it. Yeah. Everybody, we're going to do our part, Clive. So I just want to let you know that I'm out of here now, and I'm going to put on something that I was queued up before you called. I'm going to get to some, believe it or not, Ross Michael in 1980 in Cotati, California. So,
okay, cool.
So we will be in touch with you. If I don't call you, I'll email you.
All
right, Clive.
And whenever you're down in New York, feel free to come by or give me a call, all right?
Most definitely. One love, God bless, God and protect.
Same here.
All right,
Clive.
Peace. Love.
Love.